Are you glad to be free? Are you feeling lost just like me? Longing for company? Oh, Sam, Sam, you know where I am.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jack Spencer, and our special guest for this week is Sam Singh. You're the CEO now, Public Policy Associates. Congratulations on the new gig there.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great team of people we have working on a number of key critical issues facing the state, like workforce development, K-12 education, criminal justice reform. So it's a great organization to be leading at this point in time.
A little later, we're going to have Doug Roberts, the former state treasurer and budget director, joining us via telephone. But first, Sam, I thought we could talk a little bit about the various reform, government reform ideas that are kicking around right now, thanks to the negotiations between the legislative leaders, Voters Not Politicians, and the Chamber of Commerce. And a lot of different ideas being kicked around that they'd like to kind of get together as a kind of a deal of sorts. Why don't we just get your initial reactions to what you're seeing so far?
Well, I think it's important conversation to be had. I think what I've watched over the last 10 to 15 years is this conversation, especially around term limits, is an ongoing conversation that doesn't go anywhere because it hasn't really been tied to something else that the voters want. Because I think if you look at any polling, the voters actually like term limits. They don't know why it's been created the dysfunction that we have right now. So they don't understand it, and that's why they don't want to change it. But if you add things such as financial disclosure, making sure that lame duck is in a different format than it is today, a lot of those types of things, FOIA reform, I think you add all those pieces up, I think then the general public would really go for some type of change on term limits. And I think that's the right conversation to be having. The devil's obviously going to be in the details and how that's actually implemented. But I do think it's actually a good conversation that's happening here in this environment.
It seems like one of the problems, guys, that we've had with term limits is everybody's got their idea on what to do with term limits, whether you expand the number of years to, you know, just make it like, let's say, 4 terms for the House, or you expand it 12 years for the Senate, 12 years for the House, or you combine them together, you just eliminate them all together, you tie it to pay. Everybody's got an idea.
Well, it's everybody's favorite problem to solve in Lansing, Michigan, right? I mean, because we always talk about it. And then with term limits, we watch the set of leaders go through. And sure enough, approaching the end of a leader's career, he or she brings up, well, gosh, we should really revise term limits. And one of the tough problems is, how do you do this without the legislature looking enormously self-serving, which will just send it right down the pipes and then down the drain anyways? So it's going to be interesting to see how you do that. Can you actually remove existing sitting lawmakers and leave those limits on them, yet let former lawmakers come back and complete a longer period of time? It's going to be interesting to see how they address that.
In my memory of when the pro-term limit people actually ran ads on this stuff, when somebody would jingle and talk about it, the absolute first thing they hit was they're feathering their own nest. And I believe the only legislation, I may be mistaken, that said, okay, this starts after we leave, was Brian Kelly, and I think that didn't have any, nobody had any interest in doing that at all.
Yeah, but I think you look at other states, you know, California passed term limits very similar to Michigan with the very restrictive limits that we had. They went back to their voters and they made changes. And that's because they brought different partners to the table. And I think that's what's really unique about this conversation. It's not just leaders having this conversation, which is what I've seen in the past. But the fact that Voters Not Politicians and the Michigan Chamber are in the same room having a conversation, those aren't two groups that you see with one another. Obviously, they're suing each other, or at least the chamber is suing Voters Not Politicians on their most recent initiative. But I do think they both are the adults in the room saying, hey, we can actually make some significant change. And what's different about Brian Kelly is that was more of a political gimmick, in my opinion, versus what's happening here is you've got a group like Voters Not Politicians that has a network throughout this whole entire state. And if those volunteers believe in these types of reforms, they'll get those signatures, which was part of the difficulty that the lieutenant governor had with his part-time legislature proposal.
Oh, the plan is to get signatures? I thought this was going to be something the legislature might have done and put on the ballot.
It sounds like it's a mix from what I've heard, because some of the stuff, you don't want to make too big of a too complicated of an initiative, which, yes, you have to have something go in front of the voters because you've got to amend the Constitution, because term limits is a constitutional amendment. So the other stuff is statutory, so I don't know how you bundle it all together. Maybe you can...
Well, again, I've not been in that room, so I can't tell you what those details are. I do think there could be a set of conversations that are done by the legislature putting it on the ballot, or they could go back to the voters. Because, again, sometimes if you take these ideas, and the politicians might not have the political courage to put them up. But those ideas could have been vetted by these groups and then moved on to a door-to-door campaign that actually gets signatures to put this on the ballot. So I think that's part of what we have to wait and see, what is going to be the actual final format. But regardless of whether it's getting actual signatures, those volunteers are going to be key to get that message out. Because you're absolutely right. National groups are going to come in, put a bunch of money in and say, don't change term limits, right? U.S. term limits, whatever that group is out of D.C., will come in and blanket a lot of money. And so you're going to need people on the ground. And that's where voters, not politicians, I think, can be a really powerful ally in this conversation.
I've got a question. Why do you even need the legislators at all? If you do it by getting petitions, why can't it just be the chamber, some other groups, and voters, not politicians? Because to me, you have a little more flexibility without the legislature.
That's probably right. The question is, do you have the resources? Because when you look at these proposals, with the exception of the voters, not politicians, it's been close to three decades before you had real citizen-engaged petitions that actually got there without huge amounts of money tied behind it. And so I'm sure the part of these initial conversations are you could take $2, $3 million out of the mix by having the legislature put them forward. But I wouldn't be surprised if you get to a point where the legislature can't do some of the things that are being asked for, and this doesn't go to a voter initiative where they actually move things forward. So I agree with you that it's probably easier to do some of that, but I think what happens right now is you want to take at least the first crack to see what the legislature could be able to do, and that saves a significant amount of money for everybody. That's going to be a very expensive battle as we go into 2020.
Well, the other thing is, too, is if you can get some of that done statutorily through the legislature, then it prevents it from having to go on the ballot and then making something like a Reform Michigan Government Now, where it becomes like this enormous 20-page ballot proposal that people are overwhelmed by, and then also subjects it to a legal challenge from, let's say, the term limit group saying you're changing too many sections of the Constitution, so it can't be legal. So if you can do things legislatively and then tie it to something simple like a reform of the term limits, maybe that is the way to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we'll see what happens over the next couple of weeks. You know, I think there's been a lot of hope that we can start getting back to some conversations around policy, some conversations about the budget and so forth. And so regardless of what's happening, we do need to begin to have conversations. Now, this can help restart some of the relationships and conversations that have sort of broken down over the last few weeks. I think that's also a helpful byproduct of this conversation.
Oh, that's news. You mean some relationships have broken down?
Not to bring up broken relationships, but I'm curious your reaction to some of the line-item vetoes that the governor initiated, her strategy, and where you think we're at as far as, I guess, restoring some of those funds.
Well, I'm surprised that it's taken this long for everybody to really be fully back at the table. I know that there's conversations happening back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, but my sense is you've got this deadline of Thanksgiving, and the legislature is always known to hit deadlines. And so if you got a deadline of Thanksgiving, let's use that. Obviously, the next one's not till the holiday break in December. And you have real groups that if they don't have these resources, they're going to be laying staff off. Some groups have already done that. I was with a person who works for Aquinas College, and he was just talking to me about the number of students who get that scholarship at around $2,500 from the state. And those kids can't afford to go to college. So that's a real impact that's going to be happening. I know people now are getting more and more concerned about that. So I think offices are hearing more and more from the general public about this. But my sense of this last month of everybody grandstanding, okay, that was great. You got your hits in both ways, but now it's time to really get to the bottom line and actually get some of these items restored. And I think the general public wants that. I know the constituencies of both Democrats and Republicans want that. But this idea that we have to continue the fight, they both have done it, but let's get back to the table and fix this because we have some real policy issues we should be debating as well.
Well, I think that's what's so interesting about what happened is we had this totally bizarre situation take place where the deadline, the shutdown threat was bypassed. And it's, I think it's interesting that you bring up the idea that you need deadlines, and we're sort of like, well, what do we do now? There isn't a particular deadline we have to meet.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody overplayed their hands, you know, in this whole process. You know, it was clear that when the Republicans never released a Rhodes plan, that they were never coming up to a serious conversation around that. That, I think, then made, you know, the executive branch react in a certain way. There was obviously that window when they were all willing to negotiate, but it seems like Republicans put too many caveats on that. And that's why we got to this point of when the deadline of the budget should have been the deadline, you know, she went ahead and used her powers. I think that might have surprised some of those Republicans, but it shouldn't have. They should have known that they sort of, you know, took their time, slow rolled us all over the summer. That why wasn't she going to do the same thing that they were doing to her? Well, they both did that. Now let's be grown-ups. Let's get back to the table and let's actually negotiate that. And that's where I think we should be at. And I think now that we've gotten away from the press focusing on those vetoes, now people are talking about the real-life consequences of those cuts. And that's why I think both sides will have to get to the table. My fear is that they might wait till that December deadline instead of the Thanksgiving deadline. And that's going to have some real-life implications for people.
Well, walk us through this, though, Sam. How do we get out of this morass we're in right now? How do you see a path where we can kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again?
Well, I think it's a little bit, the Republicans right now are asking too much. They have now gone too far by saying, hey, we want you to take your administrative powers away from the governor. No governor is going to do that. It doesn't matter what party they're from. And so the question is, are they willing to take these line item vetoes that they care about, that Democrats care about, put them back on the table? I bet you that the governor would actually make some kind of commitment that I'm not going to, you know, make any changes to these because I'm actually at the table this time versus when you did a budget where I wasn't at the table. So to me, I think you have to look at every situation in that one moment of time. But this idea that she's going to give up some power for the next three budgets is just ludicrous. And I think for anybody in this town, that's even an idea that's being floated around in caucus rooms just shows to me that lack of experience. The leaders, I think, no different. But those caucus members who just got here in the House, if that's what they're demanding, then you're not going to have functional government for the rest of this two-year term.
The idea is then is they can get the governor to commit to not doing the administrative board transfers anymore. Then they can actually start talking about restoring some of the line item veto cuts. But what about the transportation funding? Because that's something that's really at the key to all this. This is why we're at the spot that we're in is because the governor put down a 45-cent gas tax increase. And she needs a gas tax increase or she needs some kind of increase to properly fund roads and other government services. So how do you get to that next layer?
Well, I think that's the unfortunate part because right now all we're talking about is these supplementals. And it seems like the conversation around roads has sort of taken that back seat even further than it has. And so that's why I do think it's another important reason why they have to fix these supplementals now, get that done with, because you have to get to a roads solution. Everyone acknowledges that problem. Doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican. The question of how you get there has been the debate. But the fact that there's not any negotiations happening on the roads at all, and hasn't been for months now, is really problematic for the state and our future. But again, let's fix the supplemental piece. That's what I think everyone's ready to do right now. And then we can get back to the roads conversation.
Can't you make the argument that basically what fixes the supplemental piece is that the governor gets to negotiate, gets to have the negotiations she didn't get to have in the first place?
Absolutely. And that's why I think any type of long-term conversation won't happen. You have to have this short-term conversation because the governor was not in the room when that budget was put forward. And that's why she used all the powers that she had legally given to her. She used all of those. And the fact that Republicans are surprised by that surprises me and I think a lot of people around this town. Now let's get back. Let's negotiate that. I believe that if whatever was negotiated in this next few weeks, that will be honored throughout the rest of that budget process. We've got another budget that's going to be coming around just around the corner. And then we have a second, conversation around that. But this idea that you can tie future budgets or future powers of the governor over this supplemental conversation, I don't think is something that's basically a non-starter.
Now, on the road funding question and doing that, hey, look, let's say this thing gets done by December 1st, is there even time to do the road funding? Because next year's an election year.
Listen, no one's paying attention to that election until filing deadlines and things like that. There's enough runway space in the first quarter, even into the second quarter, to make difficult decisions on that. Now, I also think there should be some serious conversation put to what could be put in front of the voters. You know, I mean, during the campaign, the governor did say if the legislature's not willing to tackle something this difficult, then maybe it's time for the voters to tackle this. And you've seen this in other states where other states have created investment opportunities. And so maybe that's the path. If the Republican legislature is not willing to tackle hard issues, then maybe it's time to take it to the voters. But I do think there's enough runway space in the first quarter before that spring break recess that you could have something that is done by all sides. And because both sides would have to have skin in the game, I think it becomes really hard to make it a political issue against one party or the other, but everyone's got to come to the table, and that's what I think you can get done in that first quarter of next year.
Can we have you put on your political hat a second?
Sure.
I wanted to get your commentary on the Democratic presidential primary. Obviously, Bernie Sanders was in town over the weekend with Rashida Tlaib trying to regenerate the mojo. Can he regenerate the mojo, or has he lost the moment?
Well, I think if you compare where we were, you know, 4 years to today, I think he is sort of fallen to the wayside. I do think probably these endorsements by Congressman Tlaib, AOC, and others will help get a little bit of a charge. But I think right now this race really is between the Vice President, Joe Biden, and Elizabeth Warren. I think those are the two front runners. I think that's what you'll see come January, February, and March. And I'd be surprised if anybody else makes it into that circle with those two.
Even Mayor Pete? You like Mayor Pete, don't you?
I like Mayor Pete. My wife is a big supporter of Mayor Pete. I think he makes a lot of sense, and he's able to communicate in a way that a lot of the other candidates have not been able to figure out how to communicate to the public. But again, if I take a look at the resources that have been raised, the name visibility, and then sort of the ground games that are happening right now in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, I still think right now it's a two-person race between the Vice President and Elizabeth Warren.
On that topic, let's say Bernie just stays where he is in terms of the polling and everything, and at some point, you know, he can talk about his health or whatever and get out. Where do those people go? Wouldn't Warren be the natural place for Bernie to endorse or something like that?
Well, I do think there is a lot of similarity between some of their platform pieces. And so, and I think some of the people that he's lost in these last 4 years seem to have gone to Elizabeth Warren. I've not done any data to analyze that, but my guess is that, you know, part of that group that he had has now moved on to other candidates, and Elizabeth Warren being one of those. But I think in the end, you know, Democrats are going to be very unified. I don't think you're going to see what happened 4 years ago. I think Democrats know that they want a change in the White House, and there'll be a very spirited primary season and caucus season in the first few months of next year. But I do think whoever's there, you'll see that gel in a way that did not happen in 2016.
So if you can see our board here in MERS World Headquarters, we've been playing the next-to-drop game among our staff and our inside consultants. As you take a look at the next-to-drop, we had to revamp it because Tim Ryan dropped out and a bunch of us got points. John?
Yep, we got points.
And so now we have moved on, and as you can see, a lot of us have picked Julian Castro because we don't have confidence he can raise $800,000 by Halloween. Is Castro a good bet, or would you pick somebody else as the next presidential candidate to drop?
I'm looking at that, and I see Bullock's still up there. Is he still running?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the interesting thing. I make that almost as a joke, but is anybody talking about him? And so at some point,
for U.S. Senate, I think.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay.
No, that's for president. But I think I've heard people talk about Bullock for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, absolutely. I could see that type of change. I think you could see a lot of those things happen in this next few months. You know, I wouldn't be surprised as Castro makes a potential transition. Taking a look at a Senate run could be something that could happen there. You could see the same thing with Bullock, right? You saw that with the former governor of Colorado. And so I do see that there's some of those opportunities. But you're probably right. Castro is probably the person that takes the next step out just based on some of the fundraising in the last couple of quarters.
It's always sad to see the gang break up, but it's just the nature of the business, I suppose. Last thing I wanted to ask you about before we let you go, John Conyers, of course, dying over the weekend. Any thoughts on his passing?
Well, you know, he was such an instrumental part of the civil rights movement and in Congress, and the longevity that he had and the issues that he talked about at one point were considered, you know, too radical. But now when you take a look at health care and what he wanted to do with health care, you know, it's become really common for that to be the part of the conversation, especially around what we have here in the Democratic Party and what that kind of commitment is to the residents of our country. So, you know, it's obviously a sad day when I saw that come over the news media yesterday, but I think people remember him for that civil rights commitment. One of the things I didn't really know, because obviously it was pretty young during the time, is, you know, as I've been reading some of the obituaries and so forth, was that he was number 13 on President Nixon's enemies list. And, you know, being in that top 20 of that enemies list is probably a badge of honor to have and so forth. And, you know, obviously the impact that he had while he was on Judiciary Committee, and especially during that last impeachment, as conversations of impeachment happen right now. But, yeah, he obviously was a great champion for Detroit and for civil rights. And I know we send our respect to his family.
I think we were talking a little earlier about this, and I said it on Ackerley this morning. He probably could have left 15 years earlier than he did from Congress.
Well, I think there's always that conversation that all of us in elected office think about. You know, when is the right time to make a transition and so forth? And each person's got to make that decision amongst themselves. But his impact that he made being in that office and the questions that he would ask in his prime and judiciary, you know, were things that, you know, I think have made an impact on the country. And so I know that a lot of people will debate a number of topics like that, but he definitely made a significant impact on civil rights and for his fighting for his constituency back in Detroit.
Sam Singh, the CEO of Public Policy Associates, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us on the other end of the line is former budget director, former treasurer, and former Senate Fiscal Agency director, Doug Roberts. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, sir.
Ed, it's my pleasure.
You had the opportunity to serve in Lansing when Governor Bill Milliken was the governor, and we thought we'd start the podcast, this interview, by getting maybe some of your biggest memories in serving with Governor Milliken, and what came to mind when you heard of his passing?
Of course, I was very saddened. I think that Governor Milliken was an outstanding leader, an outstanding person. And the stories that that I have are from the last 5 years of his tenure. As we know, Governor Milliken was the longest-serving governor, 14 years. I served with the governor the full last 5 years of his tenure, from 78 through 82. I'd like to do a couple stories in terms of 1982, simply because it was a terrible economic year. People either forget, or maybe they weren't alive at the time, the numbers in Michigan, I'm going to give them to you in a minute, were truly almost astronomical in terms of how bad things were. The unemployment rate for the U.S. in 1982 was 9.7%. The unemployment rate in Michigan for the entire year was 15.6%. Some of the unemployment around Flint was close to 25%, and yes, that's the D word, that's called depression. It was a terrible time. And my story begins with, in Michigan at that time, and it's still, I think, in the law, I don't think it's used as much, when revenues did not come up to expectations, the governor issued what was called an executive order. Now, an executive order was a cut in the budget, but that cut had to be approved by the appropriations committees of both the House and the Senate. And so January of that year, revenues are falling, an executive order is issued, and it's tough, and it's passed. Then in February, there is another need for an executive order, and I was with the governor at that time, and the governor was very clear, and his instructions were very clear to us in the budget office. I was the deputy budget director at that time. Cut more than we need. I don't want to do this again. Well, of course, the economy is falling so fast, we just can't stay in front of it. And in March, I have the responsibility to go to the governor's office and explain that we need another cut.
Wow.
This was a terrible meeting. The governor was rightfully and unhappy, and he was very unhappy. And I felt, frankly, that we had let this wonderful man down. I thought to myself that getting fired might be okay, since I wouldn't feel this bad again. After the meeting, I was really down. And Governor Milliken came up to me. He put his arm around me, and he said, if I have to stay here, so do you. I was, and I am still, overwhelmed by him. I worked even harder after that, and I believe that made me a better public servant. I mean, I believe that Governor Milliken made me a better person. And it gives you an idea of what a remarkable individual. If you don't mind, I'd like to go on from this.
Yeah, please.
Governor Milliken really disliked a cutting. And if he did so, why didn't he propose a tax increase? But he did. Governor Milliken proposed at that time a full 1 percentage point increase in the individual income tax, which at that time was 4.6%, and he proposed to raise to 5.6%. He's clearly Republican. The Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, and the Democrats were unable to get the votes. They were unable to pass it. The legislature was unable to pass this proposal, but they did pass, in effect, a six-month or a half of 1% for 1 year, which would have been okay, I guess, except that the way they passed it, it expired at the end of 82. So the point that I want to make to people who write history is that when 1982 then came into play, Governor Blanchard became governor. I also worked for him. Walked into a budget problem, of which there was, and ultimately had the very famous income tax increase, which of course changed the Senate and changed everything. But the point I'm trying to make was that way back in 1982, if they would have given the governor the full 1% that he was proposing, arguing for, was willing to sign, it may have changed history. And I just think that's something worth talking about. One other point about the budget, and I spent a lot of time with the governor on the budget. Governor Milliken was very, very much involved. He was not a hands-off. He was a hands-on governor. The budget process would allow each departmental director to meet with the governor personally with staff to go over the budget every year. So every year there were like 20 different budget meetings, of which the governor personally attended. We went over the budget for each department. The governor was very much involved. Think about this for a minute, though. 14 years as governor, he probably knew every line in the budget. I mean, he was very, very knowledgeable, and he was just a remarkable person to work for. There was one other thing that the Governor Milliken did, which hasn't happened much since, that I thought at the time made an awful lot of sense. Given that you had a Democratic legislature, he was a Republican, he knew he couldn't get anything done unless it was bipartisan. So he would often hold what was called quadrant meetings. A quadrant meeting would be the governor, the Speaker of the House, the minority leader of the House, the leader of the Senate, the minority leader of the Senate. The five of them would get together, maybe with some staff, maybe not, and to talk about the policies that might be able to get passed. And given the situation, I think it served the state extremely well. So, I mean, it really was very special to work for such a special individual.
Are there any lessons that were learned during the Milliken years that could be applied today that could make the situation in Lansing a little less contentious?
Well, ironically, it's almost identical today to what the governor faced, except, of course, it's flipped. You have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. I do not know whether or not there is the desire among individuals to get together, as a quadrant, and to see what could pass. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't know that because I'm not involved in the day-to-day issues. But I do know that the governor, Governor Milliken, always believed that good policy made good politics. And I just think that that still makes an awful lot of sense.
One of the things that have been used during this recent budget cycle is the use of the state administrative board to transfer money, the governor's ability to use the administrative board to transfer money around within a budget. Given your past experience on that, is that an effective tool? Is that something that is appropriate for the governor to have in crafting a spending document?
The answer is I do not know everything that's going on right now. I would prefer to talk about something I do know, which is the administrative board, which does not deal with Governor Milliken, but in fact does deal with Governor Engler. I was a state treasurer under Governor Engler, and Governor Engler attempted to do something very similar. And I don't think it happened, because I think that the legislature and the governor worked out a deal in which the ad board would not, in fact, make such transfers, at least at that time, in exchange for something that the governor wanted. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the details, but I do remember that this is not the first time that the issue of the ad board has come up. And for all I know, the people in the current administration knew something about what had happened under Governor Engler. But one would have to go back and do the research, and I don't remember all the details, but I knew it was attempted at that time, and the legislature and the governor worked out some sort of deal.
Doug, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, with your experience with the budget as treasurer, as a budget director, and sort of looking at our current revenue system, obviously we've got an issue with road funding. Obviously we kind of have a lagging, slow growth general fund that's probably was the same level it was, 15 years ago or so. If you had to design a new revenue system or make changes to modernize the state's tax system, what would you do?
I think that's a very fair question, and I'm not sure that I'm as concerned about the fact that it's not quite as elastic as maybe others would like. Remember that a revenue system has to engage in one other important issue, and that is long-term balance. I must tell you, when we had the economic downturn recently, in which property values fell so much, I didn't think that was possible. And of course, it did happen. Meaning, I think a revenue system needs to have more than one leg in terms of raising things. For example, I think the income tax is a very good leg. It's the ability to pay, it moves forward. I think the sales tax is on consumption. That's much more stable. It used to be that the property tax was also historically the most stable, but given some recent history, so it isn't just whether or not the whole system is elastic, meaning that the revenues continue to grow as the economy grows. It also has to consider the issue of stability over time, because I went through the 82 downturn, which I don't think anybody could have foreseen. But even when you have downturns, you need some way to mitigate it a little bit. And so I think that a multiple level of revenues is very important. Whether you want to tweak it a little bit and sing a little bit more income tax and maybe a little less sales tax, but that's a tweak. I really think that it's very important to have a balance in the system we have right now.
This is Jack Spencer. I was around back in the 1970s and the 1980s, the early 80s, and my memory of it was the term, the last person who leaves Michigan, please turn out the lights.
You're correct. I remember that as well.
And my memory of it was that the last few years of the 70s weren't exactly great. And then what people forget is the first 2 years of the Reagan administration even got worse.
I don't disagree. I have some of the charts in front of me. And let me just put it to you as bluntly as I can in terms of what that's meant to the state of Michigan in terms of even things like congressional representation. Of course, as we know, every 10 years we have a census. And in 1972, Michigan had 19 congressional members to the House. In 1982, so now they went down to 18. But in the 80s, we grew almost not at all. And in 1992, which is that 10-year period of time, we were down to 16. So it isn't just the economy, it's also your impact on Congress. It is just was a very, very difficult time. And I remember very much your phrase. Well, I mean, it was sort of a little dark humor. Well, the last one out, please turn off the lights.
Mr. Roberts, I also wanted to ask you about what was the political dynamics back when you were serving. Now in the current days, we kind of get wrapped up into our own little universe, and we think that the times that we're in are the most contentious times there's ever been. But when you were involved in the 70s and 80s, do you remember partisan politics being a constant sort of strife?
No. How's that for a quickie answer?
No, that's a great answer.
I remember. I mean, I testified on the part of both Governor Milliken. I testified in the part of Governor Blanchard. I testified to the legislature in the part of Governor Engler. Yes, there was confrontation between, say, myself, not as an elected official, but when it was all over, we still went up and talked to each other afterwards, you know, and basically said, you know, is there some place we can go that we can talk about maybe cutting a deal?
I have a question here, an economic one. You said income tax is more stable, if I understood.
No, I'm sorry. If I said that, I misspoke. If anything, the income tax is a little bit less stable, but is more elastic. It grows a little bit more with the economy. I think the sales tax is a more stable tax. And historically, we always thought as the property tax as the most stable. But the recent, when we had the big decline in property values, that sort of brought a pause to whether or not the property tax is the most stable tax.
Okay, because my question was basically, what did that 15%+ unemployment rate do to the income tax back then? Did that have a big effect?
Yes, it did. I mean, all the taxes went down. That's the reason we had to cut. All the taxes went down. As a matter of fact, the income tax probably went down more because the income tax does respond more to economic conditions than some others, because the sales tax will fall. But the fact is, and this is still true after all these years, even if you can't spend as much, you still have a certain amount of consumption. There's still a certain amount of sales tax that just is going to take place. Income tax, however, is more volatile, not extremely, but more volatile. So, yes, it did. I mean, that's the reason the revenues just fell off the table. That's the reason I felt so bad that we had misestimated so badly in 82, because we just didn't see it continuing to decline as badly as it did.
Do you believe it's time to expand the sales tax, the services, given how consumers have changed their buying habits?
I've personally always been in support of a sales tax on certain services. We all know what the pressure points are. You know, just take medical off the board. Just take, you know, sometimes you have to take certain, like the law profession off the board or something. Not because you can make a good rationalization not to do lawyers, but the fact is you just don't want to take the fight. The politics is also the art of the possible. And if you want to change something, you have to at least theoretically come up with a way of how do you get a majority to support a proposal. And yes, I mean, I was a big supporter of something which, you know, it's not always been popular, but the whole issue with internet sales, which again, is hopefully been more resolved than it was when I was around. I mean, I just thought that was a negative to the brick and mortar hometown team, and I just thought it was only fair that we somehow figured out how to deal with that issue.
Turning to the sales tax to services, is there a way to at least start out with the more optional services first?
Yes, there is. There's nothing, to my knowledge, there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents the legislature of taxing certain optional sales tax items if they want to right now in services. I'll pick on somebody and they're not going to let me out, but golf courses or bowling alleys or things like that, if you could, I mean, my golfing friends won't like this.
I'm sure, but we'll see if there's anything possible there. One more thing I wanted to ask you about. What do you tell people when you hear, where did the lottery money go?
You picked on a very, I don't know how to put this, a very raw point with me. You opened it, I'm going to give you the longer answer. I was there in 1972 when the lottery was adopted. The lottery went to the people, and the language that the people voted on said that it would be a permission to have lottery in the state. That's all it said, was that the legislature will act it. Then the legislature enacted a bill to authorize lotteries, and to permit the sale of lottery tickets in the manner provided by law. And the PA 239 of 1972 established the State Lottery Fund, listen, and earmarked all net proceeds to be deposited in the state's general fund. Now, in my opinion, over time, it became a myth that, well, the lottery was always intended to go for education. I'm sorry, in my opinion, that's just not true. But wait a second. So therefore, I mean, they said, well, the people, there was ads, and the ads said that the money would go to lottery. So I looked up the ads. The ads did say, if the lottery passes, there will be more money for K-12, comma, social services, comma, public health, comma, that's the general fund. Now, the legislature over time got hung up on this myth because the people said, you stole the lottery money. Okay, that's fine. They then earmarked all of the lottery for the general fund and then did do a shell game and took the money out of the general fund such that, for other issues, such that K-12 didn't end up with any more money. So there is truth that a shell game took place, but long after it was adopted. And so the idea, right now, I would say the lottery goes to education. Now, you know, it seems to me that without the lottery, there'd be less money. And so education is clearly a benefit. But the idea that it was initially intended, and let me make one more final point on this. And this deals with people and whether or not you believe in the goodness of certain people I'm going to name. In 1972, Bill Ryan was Speaker of the House. I think he's one of the most remarkable speakers the state ever had. At that time, the governor of the state was a guy named William Milliken. If you think either one of those two would have intentionally done something that they thought that people didn't, or that people were misled, I think you're wrong. So these two gentlemen clearly, people expected what they thought was being presented, and they put the money, they passed the law, and they put it all into the general fund, and then we know the rest is history. How's that for a long answer?
Well, that, I think you shared with me something that I've never heard before, and for that, I very much appreciate it. Doug Roberts, former budget director, former treasurer, and former head of the Senate Fiscal Agency, thank you for taking some time with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good luck.
All right, sir. All right. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Doug Roberts, Sam Singh, Jack, and John. And John, were you able to stay through the entire Michigan State football game over the weekend?
No. No, we tailgated all day. It was nice up until about the game time. And then we walked up to the stadium gates. We were able to finally get service on our cell phones because, you know, it's always sketchy right before a game because there's so much traffic. And we saw the radar coming, these really bright yellow blobs of storm headed our way. And it started raining. I said, you know, we said, I'm not sure we want to do this. Let's go home and watch it from home. I think we made the right decision.
Yeah, I think you made the right decision as well. You know what I was doing? I was watching a kids play on Edgar Allan Poe. That's how I spent the time.
Much better use of time.
Oh, yeah, because if I had watched Edgar Allan Poe or if I'd watched the football game, I still wouldn't have seen Michigan State score. So it didn't really make any difference.
You were hearing Quoth the Raven, Nevermore anyway.
Sam wasn't in the stadium, were you, Sam?
I wasn't in the stadium either. That rain was looking really bad, and so I skipped it, watched it on TV instead.
Now, if they were undefeated, would you have gone?
That might have been a different story, but right now I'm still waiting for the offense to show up, and so I'll watch those at home or at a local establishment instead of sitting in the rain.
If the Big Ten title were hanging in the balance, I might have gone for the first quarter or two.
Oh, my gosh. No, I would have been there for the whole thing. If the Big Ten title was on the balance, yes, I would have put on the poncho and gone for it.
Put up with the rain.
But to watch another goose egg,
No, wasn't worth it.
Well, as a Michigan fan, I was very much rooting for and hoping MSU could pull the upset, and that evaporated quickly. Now it's going to be, Penn State would have to lose to Minnesota and then Ohio State, and then some other strange thing would have to happen. But anyway, that hope evaporated pretty quickly.
I wouldn't put it past Minnesota. Undefeated, baby. Row the boat.
It's at Minnesota.
Row the boat. All right. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.